Tomorrow, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Hey 1:5. So again, we're sort of giving these essentially unrelated cases that have some resemblance to the case of Lo Tamura Osa Tamura. And the first case here has got to do with the Mechatas, the preparation of the purification waters, which have two basic ingredients. Those are water from a spring, Maim Chaim, and then the ashes from the Paraduma, the red cow that's burned. And the basic point of our Mishnah is that you have to put the water first into the kli and then the ashes on top of it. And that will create the mechatas, the purification waters, which are effective in purifying someone who's been exposed to corpse tuma and which will convey tuma, tanava tuma in and of itself. That works only if you put the water in first and then the ashes on top of it. If you do the other way around, then it's not effective. It's just, you know, it's nothing. Not a source of tuma, won't be a source of purification. And the reason why it's here ostensibly is because the point is even these the ashes, the parduma ashes, are kadosh for achatas. They're acceptable and consecrated for that purpose. If you don't follow the technicalities, they won't convey their kadusha, if you will, to make them more effective, meaning the purification water. It's kind of like if you have a tamura, it's, yes, it's consecrated, but won't convey its, you know, sanctity onwards, other things. That's the loose connection here, it seems. So, Misha says, Ein mechatas nasin mechatas. The purification waters aren't like halachi, we're even the saddest of purification waters. Ella imatan efer, until you put the ashes in, meaning the water goes first from the spring, and then the ashes go on top of those waters. The other way around doesn't work. If you'll ask, wait a second, I actually know my psukim very well, and the pasuk in Chukas actually says, pretty explicitly, it says, V'lachu letamei me'efar srefas hachatas. You take those ashes. V'nasan alav ma'im chaim. You put on top of it the living waters, meaning the waters from the spring. Which sounds like the ashes go first and the waters go on top of them. So why would it be here the exact opposite? So the answer is later on the pasuk, it ends with, it says, Ma'im chaim el keli. You're to put the spring water into a empty vessel, so that goes first, and then the ashes go on top. If that's the case, so what does it say that the nasin alav ma'im chaim, the water goes on top of it? To tell you another din that you have to, after you put the ashes in, you have to sort of stir it up with your finger, stirring it up such that the water from the bottom gets on top of the ashes. Okay, that's the leaving from the pasuk. That's the first case of our Mishnah. The second case of our Mishnah has to do with a beis hapras. A beis hapras is a questionable graveyard, a Suffolk graveyard, if you will. The specific case is, if you had a known grave, okay, that's the grave or graveyard, and then someone plows over that grave or graveyard. So now there's a concern, the rabbis are concerned. Listen, when you plow a graveyard, so you're taking the plow, it has that big plowshare, that massive steel or whatever, metal blade goes in the ground. It could catch on to the corpse itself and drag the bones around. And even, you know, etzem kasaora, a bone the size of a barley corn, is the source of tumah if you touch it, your tummy. So the concern is that if you've plowed over a known grave or graveyard, that bone fragments have spread, and therefore a kohen shouldn't go there, not because it's a vadai, a certain graveyard, but rather it's a Suffolk graveyard. Now, a Suffolk graveyard in this kind of context is called a beis hapras. Forget the etymology, not for now. So the beis hapras. So the question is, you know, how far can a beis hapras extend? How far does the question go? Maybe the bones are carried 10 miles away. How do you know? The rabbi said, if you plow, so you have to be concerned that the bones spread up to 100 amos from the known grave, okay? And of course, the bones would spread in the direction that you're doing the plowing. So if you have a field and on the far east of the field, there's a grave, and you plow the field from the grave westward all the way, so how far did it to be afraid that bones spread? The answer is 100 amos from that grave. And a Kohen can't go within those 100 amos because he has to be concerned he'd be stepping on or touching bone fragments that were dragged by the plow as you plowed. Now, so you have the Vadai, the certain confirmed grave or graveyard. Then you have the Beis HaPras, the Suffolk graveyard. What happens if the next year the farmer goes and he plows that Suffolk graveyard, but he plows, let's say, from the south to the north, pushing things upwards, northwards. So now, do you have to be afraid that in year one, the bones ended up, you know, to the west. And now, year two, the plow is pulling to the north. And over time, this basin process spreads further and further and further. And the Suffolk River gets more and more because maybe bones are getting dragged further and further away from the original source. The answer is no. The maximum we're afraid of bones being dragged is 100 amos from the grave, no more than that. And therefore, the idea is that even though you plow to Bais y Pras and there's a possibility there are bones in the Bais y Pras, we're not afraid that the bones from the Bais y Pras number one got dragged further away beyond 100 amos from the original grave to make a Bais y Pras number two. And since we have that principle, which is like a Bais y Pras number one can't make a Bais y Pras number two, that's very analogous to how Temura number one can't make Temura number two. Hence, it's over here. And the mission therefore says, Ein Bais y Pras, osa Bais y Pras. One Bais y Pras, which is plowed again, can't make a second further Bais y Pras. Now, the mission brings one more case before getting back to Temura, which is velo truma achar truma, which literally means you can't take truma after truma. The way the Bartender learns this is not how it sounds at all. The Bartender's understanding is as follows. There's a rule that, first of all, you have to take a tithe of all your produce, and the first tithe goes to a Kohen. It's called truma, right? Now, you're supposed to give, let's say, 2%, ideally. That's the Benoni amount of truma to be given. Only a person who owns the produce can take the truma. If I would separate a truma from your produce, that's ineffective. It doesn't have the status of truma, so meaning it could still be eaten by non-Kohen, etc. Now, if you have partners, so both of them are owners of the truma, and neither can take truma without the consent of the other one. So if you have Reuven who separates, you know, truma from the produce, and then Shimon, the other partner, separates truma from that same produce, so that would clearly indicate they haven't been talking to each other, because why is Shimon taking if truma already took? Why is Shimon already taking if Reuven already took? And that being the case, we're seeing that not only did Shimon ostensibly not give authorization to Reuven to take the tithes, but also Reuven didn't give authorization to Shimon to take the tithes, and therefore both of them are tithing, separating truma from stuff which doesn't belong to them, without is not authorized them to take because they don't have full rights because they're partners, and therefore their truma taking is not valid. We'll have to both start again. And that's, according to the Bartender, what it means when it says velo truma achar truma, which means if there's a second truma taken after the first, then it's not considered truma, neither is considered truma, because by the fact the second person took the partnership, it clearly indicates that the first person wasn't authorized to take or he would have taken in the first place, and certainly the second the same way. Okay, now we come back to our regularly scheduled program. We're talking about Temura, and now the mission says, Velo Temura Osa Temura, which I explained before already means that even if you have animal A, which is consecrated, let's say, as an Ola, and you say you want animal B to be its substitute, it's Temura. Yes, that works. Animal B is consecrated and has sanctity of Ola as well. But if you say you want animal C to be the substitute for animal B, no, that does not work. Animal C remains unconsecrated. So that is a way of saying that the Temura animal B can't Osa Temura, can't make animal C into consecrated as a Temura as well. Similarly, Velo HaVlad Osa Temura, same goes for the Vlad, the offspring of an animal. So in other words, I consecrate a cow to be, let's say, a Shlamim, and then the cow has a baby. So the baby also has the status of a Shlamim, but it wasn't the original source of sanctification. The baby is like an offspring of it. And therefore, if I would substitute, you know, cow, for that matter, goat or sheep, B for my original Shlamim cow, so then the B would become a Temuran consecrated. But if I try to substitute the B animal for the newly born calf, which came from my previously consecrated Shlamim cow, that will not be effective because the calf that was born is not the original source of the consecration, and that's the idea here. It's based on the Pasuk, because the Pasuk says, Hu Temura So, Yeh Kodesh, we're talking singular terms here, and therefore it's just Temura So and not more than that, okay? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Havlad Ose Temura, the Rabbi Yehuda says, no, actually the child born from the mother actually could create Temura. It's based on a pasuk. He agrees that you have the singular thing, Temura So is singular, but he says there's also the word Yihyeh Kodesh. The word Yihyeh comes out, it shall be another case, which will be a Temura, which is the Vlad, the offspring, which can make the now animal be Temura. Says Rabbi Yehuda. However, the Chacham disagree with that. They don't agree with that drush. They say the Yihyeh of that pasuk comes to teach you something else. It teaches you that if a person makes a Temura b'shogeg, in other words, for example, he meant to say he wants the white cow to be the Temura, but he said the black cow should be the Temura. So then, indeed, it's the black cow that becomes Temura, which is kind of unusual. Usually, you need to say what you mean and what you say for karbonos and hekdeshos to work. But in the case of tamura, there's this leniency, like whatever stricture, whatever called. And therefore, that's what the Yehia comes to teach you. And therefore, the rabbis disagree with him, Rabbi Yehuda, that is. And they say, Amrulo, hekdesh osa tamura, velo havlad, velo tamura osa tamura. They say, no, only the original consecrated animal can make tamura, whereas a tamura or the offspring cannot make tamura. And the halacha will be like the chachamim, that indeed only the original animal can make tamura, not the offspring or the tamura. Now, the Bartanura hastens to add that although it's true that the offspring or the tamura can't make tamura, the original animal can make multiple tamuros. So if you 10 times in a row bring new animals to substitute the original animal, each of those 10 animals will indeed become tamura animals, and each one's a separate lav, and you get malchus lashes for each and every animal separately. And that's true whether you do them 10 one after the other or 10 all at once.